Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Curious Mind. Today, I want to reflect on a topic that is interesting for me, both for psychological reasons in my psychotherapy practice, and also as a practitioner of meditation with a strong background in Buddhist meditation. I call this episode Toxic Mindfulness because over the years, I have seen how in a misleading way people have applied the idea or the concept of mindfulness to their everyday life and also to their meditation or mindfulness practice. So over the past about 20 years, we obviously have seen a popularization of the term and the concept of mindfulness, be it as an applied in stress reduction or as a therapy method or in meditation, or generally as a means and kind of a label to improve the feeling of oneself and to the improvement of quality of life. All of these have been slapped on with a basic label or practice of mindfulness. Yet many practitioners treat mindfulness in isolation as an isolated tool, as if what I practice had nothing to do with me as a person, an individual, as if it had nothing to do with my biography or my subconscious, or with me as a human being as a whole. So this would be okay if I could deal with isolated, objectified techniques. So for example, when I construct a bridge as an engineer, it does not matter much how I feel, how the technique of building a bridge relates to my unconscious, as long as I apply the basic tools, the framework, the understanding of mathematics, of statics, of material sciences properly, as I have learned to do as an engineer with bridges, for example, I'll be fine and the bridge will stand. The quality and the quality of the bridge does not depend on my mental composition as long as I apply all the necessary rules. If I deal, on the other hand, with something that, like the meaning of life, like needs, values, quality of life, the relationship with myself, the relationship to others, the world as a whole, or in short, about living, if I deal with living as a whole, then I cannot use isolated techniques. I need to build connections. I have to find meaning. I have to relate everything to me, to my experiences, to my aspirations. And this is exactly what spiritual traditions, good philosophies, and comprehensive frameworks of psychotherapy and psychology, this is what they do. They relate the individual parts always back to the whole being, the whole entity of myself. Initially, when we encounter such frameworks, be it philosophy, spirituality, or psychology, it is not important that this framework is correct, that this framework is right. What the job of the framework is that it connects the isolated, fragmented aspects of my mind and my unconscious so that my whole being has a common vision, so that all the isolated parts within myself pull together in one direction and do not fight each other as they usually do in everyday life. So when we approach mindfulness or therapy or meditation in a technical way, applying tools, we make exactly the mistake of taking limited ideas, limited objectifiable concepts, and applying that to me. In other words, I view myself as an object, as something that can be manipulated or fixed. I deal with life and living as a technique, which is clearly not. And in doing so, this is the most important thing, in doing so, without knowing it, I will bring in all the unhealthy, unreflected qualities that are within me into the way that I practice mindfulness or attention or intention or meditation. I cannot help but to do this. So whenever I deal with life as a whole, within myself or in relationships, I always bring my whole being into it. And this is why I cannot separate isolated tools or techniques in a healthy way. I bring in worst case, my greed, my blindness, my self-manipulation, my fears, my lack of energy, my impatience, my lack of frustration tolerance, my wishful fantasies about how great I would like to be when I have successfully implemented some technique, or how great my current experience is at that moment. All of these biases, all of those aspects of blindness, I necessarily bring in to the situation when I try to improve my quality of life, my outlook on life, with such limited techniques. And then whatever I do under the label mindfulness certainly will not contribute to magically eliminate my incompetence towards myself that I have kind of nourished for such a long time. If I do that, the result is a misunderstood practice of mindfulness. It starts with a misunderstanding of it being a limited technique, and it continues to be a misunderstanding. The misunderstanding is that such a limited technique could contribute to me enjoying life more, or see everything in a positive, calm way, to slow down life, or become something like a caricature hedonistic little Buddha. All of these projections, all of these expectations towards any mindfulness or meditation technique must remain empty, wishful fantasies. And precisely because we practice bypassing our inner reality with such a tool-oriented perspective, and because we are not taking all parts of ourselves with us, our mindfulness practice must become unpleasant or boring or pointless. And if we come to that point, we have to make a change. Because, make no mistake, many practitioners hit a wall in their practice, but what we do then is we make a change. We recalibrate our practice, we bring in more curiosity, we try to understand what is actually going on, and this is how I bring parts of myself into the practice. I understand that my response of frustration or anger towards myself and so on is a reflection of how I treat myself when I hit a wall, when I try to implement such a fanciful ideal, and then I'm bound to success, to a lack of success. But if we force ourselves to continue even beyond that point without a recalibration, then the frustration and the negative aspects of not having integrated them into the practice, they will strike back. And we will build an aversion and an allergy towards anything that is related to mindfulness in any way. And this is what I call toxic mindfulness. This is not just a stagnation, but I will burn the path to a healthy mindfulness practice for the near future. If that happens, then I will not want to know anything about mindfulness or mindfulness-related or meditation-related for a few weeks, months, or even years. I will think that everything is just a pseudo or an ineffective technique, and thus, even though something like that would be good for me, I will just have cultivated such an aversion towards anything related that it will, this aversion, this allergy will prohibit a healthy access, a new access to anything like that. And rightfully so, because I started again with the misunderstanding of trying to apply an isolated technique to my field of living. And this cannot work. So, because I have applied a technique, a tool, anything that I call mindfulness under such an approach will have little value because precisely it is not embedded in a framework that engages the whole mind, the whole spirit. To give you an example of how mindfulness is rightly embedded, I will give you the example of the ancient Buddhist framework, something that I have studied for a long time, so that you understand. As an example, again, I don't insist that the Buddhist handling of the concept and the idea of mindfulness is the correct one, but just to show you how it can make sense. So, original Buddhism, the goal of it was a radical liberation of the mind. This is partly connected to the nature of our mind in general, but there are many cultural and time-sensitive aspects to this concept. So what I mean to say is, we cannot apply what has been practiced in North India 2,500 years ago to the letter to today. We have to adapt it, but nonetheless, the practice of Buddhism is embedded in a framework that is all about the liberation of the mind, a complete liberation of the mind. And in Buddhism, this liberation of the mind is brought about by a spiritual practice. So, in contrast to other spiritual directions or religions, it's not about devotion, it's not about grace, but it's a practice, it's something that I need to do in order to bring about liberation. In this practice, and this is more specific about Buddhism, some parts of the mind are applied to other parts of the mind. Certain aspects of focusing the mind are related to parts that are resisting this focus, for example. And thereby, the practice gradually strengthens the healthy aspects of the mind and weakens the unhealthy ones. Now, in Buddhism, it all starts with some sort of a philosophy about the mind. There is a certain understanding of how the mind, the soul, the spirit are kind of mechanically working. There is a certain logic to that, and Buddhism is describing that logic. And this, again, is just an example for that represents any kind of large spiritual, philosophical, or psychological framework that develops such a grand idea. In Buddhism, it is done in a certain way. This is where it starts. And this leads to a fundamental first aspects of the practice. And this is the ethical orientation in my life. This is how the practice in ancient Buddhism has started, reorienting my thoughts, my communication, my feelings, and my actions towards a healthy ethical conduct and foundation. Then, building on top of that, so again, we have the philosophy as our basis. The first step of practice is ethical conduct. And then, based on those two pillars, Buddhism introduces and leads to a mental training in the laboratory of the mind. And this is called meditation. Now, in meditation, there is something that is kind of rightly described as mindfulness. And the Pali term, Pali is the language in which the oldest form of Buddhism was written down or encoded or memorized. That aspect is in Pali sampajanya. And I mention this term because usually when you look into literature, the term for mindfulness is called sati. And I think I can show, or we can show, I'm not the only one who sees it in this way, that sati is something else. Sati is going back to very specific aspects of the teaching of the philosophy of Buddhism and applying mindfulness to that. So sati is the memory, the application to certain aspects of the teaching. Sampajanya is the mindfulness, something that is closely related to what we call mindfulness. Now, in the teachings, in the Buddhist suttas, sampajanya is practiced before meditation as a preparatory stage. Why? It doesn't have a purpose in itself. It doesn't make life better. It doesn't make me happy. It doesn't make me whatever, anything fanciful. It has the specific purpose to prepare a certain muscle, a mental muscle, I mean, it is a metaphor, of course, for meditation. The practice of sampajanya in the Buddhist framework is to be mindful of the body movements, to be mindful of my sensory experiences, to be mindful when I eat, when I swallow, to be mindful when I go to the toilet, everything that is connected with everyday bodily experiences. The idea is not to get lost in it as a practice per se. I'm supposed to learn to flex that muscle of mindful attention to when I want it to happen. And again, there is little kind of benefit by itself in this practice. Why? Because original Buddhism is not about happiness. It's not about enjoying my food, enjoying the time with my friends. No, everything is embedded in a framework that should lead towards the complete liberation of the mind. Only in this sense, mindfulness has a value in original Buddhism. Having learned how to flex that muscle, only then we take this quality of sampajanya, the quality of mindfulness, we go into the laboratory of the mind, and we apply the quality of mindfulness to the inner working of the mind. Then I apply it, for example, to emotions, I apply it to thoughts, I apply it to the quality of the mind per se. This is how it makes sense. So this was an example of how within the Buddhist framework, mindfulness and mindful attention has a very specific spot, a purpose and a value, and how it contributes to the big goal, which in this case is liberation. Okay, so wrapping it all up, what is my recommendation? My advice is, if you cannot commit to a specific practice, be it Buddhist or philosophy such as Stoicism or skepticism or idealism or any kind of grand psychological framework, if you cannot commit to it, which is understandable, then you can also not expect the results that would come from a dedication to a big model that is designed to inspire and engage the whole mind. So you have to curb your enthusiasm, you have to curb your expectations towards the outcome of such a tool-based approach. First, do not misunderstand mindfulness and the label of mindfulness if you practice in such a tool-oriented way. Don't misunderstand it as what Buddhism calls mindfulness or any other big system calls mindfulness, but see it as a limited Western modern technique such as Pilates or jogging or nonviolent communication, something with a very limited perspective and being also conducive in a limited way to our lives. Second, don't overload your system with this isolated practice. Practice it while it's fun, let it rest when it's not fun, pick it up when you want to, or move on to the next technique, to the next tool that you think will help you in a more isolated way and will contribute to a general kind of well-being without answering the big questions of life. And third, in addition to the technique of mindfulness, also practice inattention, practice not awareness. What I mean with that is let go of the understanding that everything has to be meaningful, every experience, that you should not waste your time. Every moment needs to be filled with some psychological improvement or a spiritual improvement. Let your mind wander, allow yourself to daydream, to relax, to let loose, and to enjoy everyday life and your free time. I hope you could benefit from such warnings that I gave you about the application of isolated techniques into your daily life. Reduce your expectations towards such techniques. If you can, find with curiosity aspects that do inspire you, that you find really fascinating, and thus allow the kind of diverging aspects of your mind, the aspects of the unconscious, to come together and pull towards one goal. And with that, you can assure that you will not be fatigued and frustrated by a practice that you have not been fully interested to begin with. Let me know in the comment section if you have questions or comments, and as usual, I will try to pick them up at a later time. Thank you for your attention. Goodbye.